Hi, I'm Marilyn Smith. This is All Sides Weekend. We're talking about food and restaurants today. Joining me this morning, restaurant critic for the other paper, Miriam Bowers Abbott, and John Christensen of the Columbus Dispatch. Either one of you heard much about what's going on with area restaurants, places that perhaps were affected by storm damage or outages?
Can't say that I have. I've been distressed to notice, of course, the amount of food that's been thrown out from retailers.
I think that Target over on at Lenox was out the first couple of days and had freezer full of food that they had to toss.
Certainly, all the food that's being prepped would go off pretty fast in a restaurant. But then when the outage lasts, as long as this one did, then you have the food that's in the freezer that's going to have to be tossed. It's a terrible waste.
Yeah, I live near High Street, so we lost power Friday night and then for 24 hours, and then again Sunday night for 24 hours. And so all the restaurants that were in that area of Clintonville, which would be like Babushka's, and then there's a Panera and a yogurt place, they also would have lost power during that time period. And for me, even the things in my deep freeze, even though I didn't open it, I was smart enough to do that, even those sorts of things weren't frozen at the end of the 24 hours. So, you know, you have to wonder how much restaurants do lose even when it's in the refrigerator.
Well, in an article in the Dispatch this morning, it does mention Smith's Deli and Restaurant, which I think is in Clintonville, and how much food they had to throw away. In addition to that, it's a pay-as-you-go kind of business, isn't it? I mean, when you get an order.
Yeah, you have to pay for your inventory twice to sell it out.
Yeah, so it's kind of tough. What do you think? Do you think we could see a raise or a rise in prices because of this, or they just have to take
it? I think the restaurants are just going to have to take it in the ear, just the way that supermarkets have had to. I would hope that it would result in some pressure to have better maintenance by the utilities. And if that means a little bit higher rate, I think that everybody would be better off. I think a lot of people would pay a little extra, just like they used to, say, 20 years ago, when service was much better than it is today.
Ooh, you know, AEP tried to raise the rate on businesses, right? And then they had to back off of it. Maybe this is the...
Well, I think that was more than a little bit of a rate hike. I think that was kind of
a hard hit,
yes. But maybe this is the entryway to, see, we need that money, so you keep your freezers going. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying it could be what is.
Well, some people, this has been a week now, and some people are still without power. That's a very long time if you're a small business to have to eat the loss, so to speak.
Yes. Well, I think it's, if you go way back to when maintenance was apparently better, the longest period I can remember was in the aftermath of the blizzard of 78, and that didn't last a week.
No.
And those were terrible conditions that could not have been foreseen by any utility.
No, you're right. I don't even know if my power went off at all during that period.
So I think that's a pretty firm contrast.
Mm. You know, and the other side of the story would be like Mozart's. They were open the first day of outages. I think they got hit a little further in. But my understanding is they were so swamped as a result of no place else is open. And, you know, and it's a nice place to end up at that I think they had a really big bump the first day of outages anyway.
Well, plus with the heat, that would be a good place to go.
Yes.
292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Dale is on the line. Good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Okay. I work, and I don't want to drop names, but Cantina Laredo up at Polaris. And the first day that it happened, my apartment complex where I live, the doors blew out. But that was a whole other story. I got 2 hours sleep. And then for the next 5 days, I was called in that day. I wasn't supposed to work. For the next 5 days, the first two and the last two were somewhere around 24 hours, okay?
And outages? The first two outages?
No, the first two of the first 5 days. It went out on Friday. I didn't get much sleep. And then they called me in Saturday. I worked Sunday. I worked Monday. I worked Tuesday. I worked Wednesday. The first 2 days, minus Monday, which is kind of a reset, and then Tuesday and Wednesday, we have been literally hammered. Now, what it came down to, I think, was like moth to a light. We were the only ones that had power. And
well, of course, that is given. Anyone could get off at Polaris Boulevard. I understand Friday night, or I think, yeah, it was Friday night. There was a truck that was had tipped over at 3637, and Polaris was backed up, actually well into Saturday.
And the traffic lights weren't working anyway.
Right.
Well, either way, we were so hit, so unexpectedly hit the first 2 days and the first last days, second last days of that was just literally 24/7. They call me in, and there you couldn't keep up. You couldn't get product in. You couldn't get people in. It was, this is July. It's supposed to be like laid back kind of time, you know.
Well, if nobody can cook at home and if the stores are without food, you probably were a haven for most of these folks.
Oh, my gosh. The amount, the business. I took yesterday my day off, and I just slept. I really slept. I couldn't catch up with what was going on. And, and I have to suspect that from Chicago, where it started, through Columbus, where it was bad, through D.C., where it was bad, the storm, there are a lot of people who work in restaurants like myself, who one of the few people that had powers, who really just could not catch up, could not do it, you just barely got it done. And I'm glad to be able to take a day off here.
Well, enjoy your day off. Thanks very much for your call today, Dale. 292-8513, we're talking about food and restaurants. It brings up another issue, is some of these places with patios, and of course it's been patio season now in Columbus since March, I think. It's a tough deal. Not only are servers practically collapsing from the heat out there, but people still want to sit outside, you know, even though you'd think they'd be craving air conditioning.
But not as many, at least based on my personal experience. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of people coming in from the patios because after 10 or 15 minutes, they just can't take it.
Yeah, the nicotine draw has to be huge to get, I would think, most people out this weekend with 104-degree temperatures. Mm.
But it's got to be tough for some of these servers who are working both inside and outside. They've still got to go in to get the food. But to go from those temperature extremes back and forth, it's got to be very stressful.
It has to be. You can't dress for both of them.
No, mm-hmm. You really can't.
Except maybe at places whose names I shouldn't mention anyway.
How do you even know about such places?
Oh, I read about them in the paper.
292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm Marilyn Smith. We're talking with John Christensen of the Columbus Dispatch and Miriam Bowers Abbott of The Other Paper. How about some food-centered events that may be taking place here in Columbus now that the North Market usually has a few get-togethers during the summer?
I feel like isn't there a big wine weekend coming up? Is it next weekend?
There's an Ohio wine weekend coming up.
That's always a big one for the North Market. They have 2 days of tastings, right? A preview on Friday night and then all day Saturday.
Well, this is right up your alley, John.
It is, but I never go to those events myself because I just can't get enough wines tasted to make it worthwhile.
Hmm.
But I would encourage people to go to the Ohio one, and especially if they're not familiar with what Ohio wines can do. And in that context, if anyone's looking to make a small fortune out of a large one by acquiring a winery, Kincaid Ridge is on the market. The owners are going to retire.
And where is that?
That is in Ripley, which is, I believe, the southernmost part of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And their wines have been really causing a lot of trouble in California. Because they've, in truly blind tastings, they've been sweeping away the competition. And they make several different kinds, different styles, but they're uniformly great values for the quality that's involved.
And this is called Kincaid?
Kincaid Ridge. And you can get that, you'll certainly see a presence at the Ohio Wine Event. But you can also find them at well-stocked retailers.
And what makes this wine remarkable?
Well, they're not making it in a tropical climate, unlike California. So they're using grapes that are appropriate for their growing area, which compared to California is very much north, even though we think of Ripley as being kind of a hotbed in Ohio.
You guys are bad with the puns today. I'm going to have to catch up.
Well, it's Friday. But the rule that you can apply anywhere in the world is that a given grape gives its best expression at the northern limit of where it can survive and ripen. The price you pay for that is variations from year to year, which is why vintages used to be considered more important than they are today. But when you take that grape and grow it much to the south of its ideal limit, it gives wines, it's very easy to grow, typically it's very productive, it gives wines that are very alcoholic, very deficient in the other components, especially the acidity, and wines that are very harsh, and also wines that can't age. But it's easy to grow them, and it's easy to have what I call cocktail wines. And that's why places like Ohio and upstate New York, even Long Island, are able to produce much more food-friendly wines than the Mediterranean and semi-tropical climate of California. The exception in California is the growers who have just recognized what kind of climate they're in and are growing grapes from the Mediterranean climates of Europe. They're using those, they could produce wines that are much better structured and much more enjoyable.
John, did you see the article by Jonah Lehrer in New Yorker about blind taste tests of wine? Marilyn knows this is coming.
Yes.
I noticed that you talked about regional wines competing with French wines. In the article, just for listeners, he argued that that United States wines, even ones from New Jersey, could play on the same field as French wines. Would you agree
what
then?
What does that mean, even ones from New Jersey?
Well, I don't know. I've been watching too many Lifetime shows, so it's totally tainted my views of what New Jersey
is. Of life.
Is. Yes, yes, yes. But my favorite test, and this is further from my question, but I was just looking it over this morning, and I thought, oh, they did not. It was when they gave professional palates white wine, one brand of white wine, and then to two of the glasses they added red food coloring, and then the professionals would describe it as, you know, a fantastic
jammy.
yes I loved it. They were so influenced by the color that it affected how they experienced. So do you find that domestics are on par with the ones from Europe?
Well, it depends which domestics.
Yeah, that's
I'm very
fair
disappointed
answer.
In
careful,
what's been happening
lawyer
in
answer.
California. Well, California is still by far the number one producer, and it's hugely disappointing to see the deterioration of quality there. I have California wines, some Cabernet Sauvignons from the 1982 vintage from particular vineyards, and I can compare those to Cabernet Sauvignon being produced from that same vineyard today, and there's simply no comparison in the apocryphal sense. The ones being produced today from that same vineyard are harsh and alcoholic, and they're simply undrinkable. They're also a lot more expensive.
Interesting.
We have to take a quick break here. Amy is on the line, and we'll be joining her after this break.
This week, we let you, the listeners, program Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's your choices for the best of the last year, including Tom Robbins, Tony Shalhoub talking poop scoopers, expert news analysis from Sir Mix-a-Lot, and Carl imitating a vuvuzela. I'm Peter Sagal. You can only blame yourselves for this one, so you have no excuse not to tune in to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. 87 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny and hot with a high of 101 today. An excessive heat warning for today and tomorrow. Clear skies tonight in a low of 77. Sunny and hot again on Saturday with a high of 104.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, providing a disciplined approach to help individuals and small businesses grow and maintain their wealth. TheMontgomerySolution.com.
All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Smith. This is All Sides Weekend. We're talking about food and restaurants with restaurant critic John Christensen of the Columbus Dispatch and Miriam Bowers Abbott of The Other Paper. And as promised, Amy is joining us. Hi. You there?
Yes, hi.
Go ahead.
Last Friday started my wedding weekend, and in with this storm on Friday, we had 12 different states people came from, and I just wanted to call and compliment all three restaurants that were able to service us impeccably Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And that would be North Star Cafe and Pita Hut and then Barcelona Restaurant.
Did you ever think about canceling?
No, we had backup. We had backup in Bexley who had with Cornucopia was going to take it over on Sunday because it was the wedding. But North Star, the first two, the one in Clintonville couldn't service us, so we were able to get all of everybody fed Friday night through the Easton store, and we went and picked it up. So kudos to all three of them who showed off Columbus with a great example.
Well, thanks, and kudos to you for going through with it. I would think that was a pretty daunting storm that you might have. Let's wait.
It was a little harrowing. Why would I cancel? I've waited my whole life for this day, you know? That was great.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
292-8513. We're talking about food and restaurants today. You can also email us at allsides@wosu. We were talking about Ohio wines and how they are shining in comparison with their counterparts in California.
Well, I'm talking about the Ohio wines that are made from vinifera grapes, which is the family that makes grapes or wines traditionally in Western Europe, and which are considered the finest family. Ohio really has three industries in the wine department. The first is the long-established use of Native American grapes, like the Concord, and hybrids from the Concord, like the Catawba. The next phase that was entered into, which is still going strong, was to use French hybrids, which were crosses between American native grapes and some of the French vinifera grapes. But starting in 1968 with Marco Vineyards in Conneaut, some Ohio wineries began planting vinifera grapes, which are not as hardy as native grapes, but they used methods developed in upstate New York for getting the grapes through the winter and through the really hot and humid summers that we have. And those
Well, of course,
are the,
Conneaut's right on the lake, too. It's
yes,
not quite as
humid
as
it gets a lot of lake effect, which moderates the winter tremendously. But since then, we've had a number of wineries in both north, central, and southern Ohio plant these grapes. And they are turning out, in many cases, just outstanding wines. And even more outstanding is the price structure. They're wonderful values. So I would encourage anybody who's got any sense of adventure about food and wine to go to retailers who have Ohio wines made from vinifera grapes and try them, because it's an experiment that won't cost you much money compared to going through some of the California offerings.
Or the North Market event would also be, a great showcase and a great opportunity to do something
wonderful
like that.
Time for
yeah,
that.
Not very much money. And just by the glass. So if it's a disaster, you just walk away from that taste.
Exactly.
Well, I did a story last year about it was the first time that the Ohio State Fair was selling beer and wine at that venue. And they were basically Ohio wines. They were showing off that particular product just as they do with other products. And it seems to me that one of the statistics I heard was that within a 25 or 40 mile radius of Columbus, you can find a winery just about anywhere in the state.
Yeah, there's one in Madison, Madison County, that is just a short drive from Dublin. Raven's Ravenscrest, I think it is, or Ravenshurst. And they, the couple that started the winery planted Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, I think 25 to 30 years ago, and they planted them on their own roots instead of grafting them, which is something you normally have to do in this country because of some native pests. But they survived against all of the expert advice, and they've been able to craft some really wonderful sparkling wines that places like the Refectory are serving.
Do you know what, that this is sort of related, because you mentioned the Refectory, and we're talking about fruit. So the Refectory is hosting the Ohio location of National Rainier Cherry Day. Do you know about, and I may be saying, how do you pronounce R-A-N-I-E-R?
Depends where you're pronouncing
it. If you're in Ohio.
Or, I don't know.
Oh.
But like Prince Rainier.
Okay, yes, okay, okay. So I did okay. I didn't, yes. You know, I hate to be too redneck here. The people who produce those cherries en masse pick out one Ohio restaurant every year and to showcase the day that they pick and peg as the day when the cherries are in their prime, and then that restaurant gets like 200 to 400 pounds of them. So the Refectory got that this year, and they're doing some kind of giant dessert on the 11th. You said Refectory, and I thought, oh, I'm going to forget to say
that. So that's
that.
July?
July 11th, yes.
Yeah. Couple
coming
days
up,
away.
Yeah.
What I like about events like that is that it's helping start the trend towards naming the varieties of fruits. We've taken it for granted that apples are sold according to their variety, but think of all the other fruit in any kind of market, even an upscale one, which are just sold as generically, say, apricots, mm-hmm. peaches, and for that matter, even grapes. And this is a trend getting away from that and recognizing that there are hundreds of different kinds of varieties of almost every fruit, every common fruit, except for the banana.
Is that true? There's just one kind of banana?
Pretty much. It's a long story.
We have an email from Dan who says he has family coming into town later in the month, and he wants to make a reservation to take them out. He's heard good things about Milestone 229 because
pretty.
Of the location and the view. How about the food? That's his question.
I've not been there.
My question is where to park. Kind of sits
Lazarus parking garage, right? Or not Lazarus parking garage, but there's one. There is a parking garage that's close by, and I don't mind the meters that are nearby on the street too. That never. It's a quarter for 20 minutes now. So for $1.50, you can stay for 2 hours, which is longer than I want to stay anywhere.
Have you done a review?
I have. It's a very similar menu to Columbus Brewing Company. So
and then that's sort of the parent company, at least in terms of operation.
Right. I'm making sure I'm checking my brain, but that's what I remember. So it's somewhere between. Like a nicer version of Fridays. I hate to put it, you know, but if someone's wanting to know what to expect. So they have like flatbreads, they have burgers, they have more continental things like steak and fish, and they do a good job. I mean, I think they've made a lot of people's top 10 new lists, so I think they won't be disappointed. And the fountains are cute, and if they get there when the lights are going, that's even cuter.
292-8513, we also have an email from Sarah, who wants to recommend Latitude 41, great food, great atmosphere. And she says she loves the appetizer made with homemade chips and feta dip. Latitude 41 is often overlooked, I think, because it's downtown and it's in a hotel.
Exactly. There's a curse in this country about hotel restaurants. The assumption here is that you can't ever have a good or let alone a great restaurant in a hotel, but we've had a number of contradictions to that fashionable idea, starting with the Hyatt on Capitol Square a long time ago. I don't know what it's like today, but they had very serious operations. The Convention Center Hyatt also had at one time a very serious restaurant, and Latitude 41 started off as an upscale operation that changed and still changes its menu every day. That's unusual.
And they're now
for
sporting a garden up on the roof, right? Growing some of their own herbs and produce.
Yeah. I haven't been there since the new chef took over, but every visit I've had before then has been pretty good.
292-8513, we're talking about foods and restaurants. And Rod is joining us, who wants to know a little more about Ohio wine.
Yes, I had a question. What would be considered good vintages of Ohio wine? And I was wondering, about the grape growers in California. I was wondering if they're moving their operations farther north so they can grow the French grapes and, maybe even into Oregon or whatever, in likes of growing farther north or whatever.
Well, I'm sure the number of them would like to, but it's really a tough thing to do to actually move a vineyard. Although, having said that, the people who opened Kincaid Ridge moved to Ohio from Oregon, where they had a successful winery. But I've talked to a number of Oregon and Washington State winemakers who were complaining about what they say is global warming effects on their vineyards, making their climate a little too warm for some of the northern grapes that they're growing. You asked about vintages on Ohio wines. The easiest way to check that out, I think, is to call or go online and look at Marko Vineyards. It's M-A-R-K-K-O. And you can get the owner's opinion of vintages by looking at his pricing. He prices strictly according to what he thinks the wines are worth, and in his opinion, which ones are from the best vintages.
Okay, and that was Marko, M-A-R-K-K-O, wines.com, or?
I think it's Marko.com. They're in Conneaut, and so a quick Google search will turn it up. And they're still the kind of the grandfather of Ohio wines made from vinifera grapes, and I would definitely start with them. If you want to be at a much lower end of the price scale, you can find wines from Firelands Winery at quite a number of places in Columbus, including restaurants, even including a French restaurant like the Châtelaine operations. But you can get many of their wines at retail for something like $10, and you can do your own taste tests.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You have a good day.
Thank you. I couldn't give you vintage recommendations because Ohio has so many different pockets of climate that there wouldn't be a way to give you a recommendation that would hold true across the state.
Okay, so you might have one year that was good for Ohio River wines and another one that was good for the lake wines and so forth.
That's absolutely right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. You have a good day.
Thank you very much for your call today, Rob. And Phil is calling from Dublin. And you have a question about a winery in southern Ohio?
Yeah, you had mentioned Kincaid Ridge. And not too far from there is a restaurant and winery called Moyer's. And my wife and I go down there. We've got a place near there. And just love that restaurant. It reminds me of the real nice restaurant Mom and Dad used to take you out to in the 70s. But they've done a good job of keeping it up. And the wines are really, I'm not much of a connoisseur of wine, but it's a place that we actually do order wine with our meals because we really enjoy it there. And just wondered if your guest is familiar with it and what he thinks of their product.
I know of the Moyer Winery, but I have not been to the restaurant. And tell you the truth, it's been so long since I had one, I can't even recall which area they operate in, whether they make vinifera wines or French hybrids or wines from Native American grapes. Do you recall what you ordered?
I just know that they have a house red that we really enjoy, and which is unusual for us. We both prefer white. Like I said, I'm not much of a connoisseur, but it's a fantastic little restaurant. It's probably about a half-hour drive to along the river going east from Ripley, where the Kincaid Ridge is, and it's a nice little outing. It's a nice restaurant.
Well, because of the hospitality of the Ohio River Valley, for at least for American grapes, until the 1870s, it was responsible for Ohio being the number one wine producer in the country.
Oh, really?
And it was not until a blight in that decade wiped out a lot of the plantings that Ohio fell to number three behind California and New York. But it held to number three for probably, I'd say, 80 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting. I never realized that there was that much down there until we started going down there. When I've thought of Ohio wines, I've always just thought of, you know, up in the Lake Erie region, and it's two totally different products.
Well, I was stunned that the people who planted Kincaid Ridge were able to turn out vinifera, wonderful vinifera-based wines in that kind of a climate, because while the winters are less harsh there than they are in most of the rest of the state, the summers are really tough. And
and
you have to really watch for fungal infections of the wines, of the vines.
Yeah, do they have a sampling room and everything at Kincaid Ridge? Or?
Yes.
Okay, we'll need to swing by there next time we're down there.
Well, thanks very much for your call this morning, Phil, 292-8513. We're talking with John Christensen of the Columbus Dispatch and Miriam Bowers Abbott of The Other Paper. And apparently we're talking about food and wine today. If you have any questions about either, give us a call, 292-8513, and Robin is joining us.
Hi there.
Go.
Well, my name is Robin Coolidge. I'm actually the winemaker of Wine Dot Winery here in Columbus, and I just wanted to call real quick. I heard you talking about the traditional viniferas and the French-American hybrids and the Americans. I just wanted to put a plug in for some of the French-American hybrids. There's some very nice hybrid wines being made in Ohio that are definitely worth a try.
Well, the best one I've found from more than one winery has been the wines made from the Chambourcin, because I believe that they're competitive with Cabernet Franc-based wines from the Loire Valley in France, which to me is a very high standard.
Chambourcin's a really nice variety. It's very difficult to make good wine from, but if it's grown right and vinted right, it makes a very nice wine. There's also, you can find some very nice Traminettes in Ohio. Have you tried that one?
I've tried Traminettes from New York State, mostly.
Yeah, the Traminette is a hybrid from Gewürztraminer, and retains a lot of that spicy character that a Gewürztraminer has, and it's a very nice wine in a lot of places in Ohio. You can also find Foch occasionally that's made very nice, and I've even had some Bacca Noir as well. They're a little lighter, are very nice.
Yeah, as I recall, the Traminette is a fairly modern development, and the other two you mentioned have been well-established for probably a century.
Yeah, that's correct, yes.
Well, thank you very much for your call today. 292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we're going to take a short break here. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, James Murphy, founder of the dance indie rock band LCD Sound System. The new film, Shut Up and Play the Hits, documents LCD Sound System's farewell concert last year at Madison Square Garden. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And it's time to get off the interstate and enjoy the scenic beauty of Ohio's small towns. Join WOSU Public Media and the Ohio Humanities Council for a road trip around Ohio. Mondays during Morning Edition, learn about a unique part of the Buckeye State, from Marion to Chillicothe, and from the neighborhoods of Cleveland to Underground Railroad paths near Cincinnati. It's a road trip around Ohio. Listen Mondays during Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News. And for more information, visit seeohiofirst.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. Information about how Montgomery & Associates can help you achieve your financial goals is at themontgomerysolution.com.
88 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny and hot today with a high of 101. Clear skies tonight, a low of 77. Sunny and hot again on Saturday with a high of 104. And there is an excessive heat warning for today and tomorrow. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Smith, and we're talking about food and wine restaurants here in Columbus. Miriam Bowers Abbott of The Other Paper and John Christensen of the Columbus Dispatch are guests this morning, and Phil has been waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, I just pulled off the freeway. I'm at a rest stop on 71 just south of Newark, or Delaware. To learn about Ohio wines, my suggestion would be to talk to Roger Gentile, who is the proprietor of Gentile's, the wine cellars on King Avenue. It's the best wine store in Columbus. They've been there 50 years. Roger's an absolute expert on wine and Ohio wine, and he's counseled me about it numerous times, and he will give anybody a straight recommendation of best value, best vintages, et cetera.
He's also the author of an excellent book on Ohio wines, the first person to write one.
And that's right. I forgot about that.
And there has been a more recent one written by another author whose name I can't recall from the hard drive.
He's a great guy. He won't try and upsell people. He'll give them the straight scoop.
No, and I think he has an excellent palate, which for me is the most important thing to find in a retailer.
Anyway, that's my vote. Have a good day.
Thank you, Phil. Thanks for calling 292-8513. That was Gentile's Wine on King.
Yes.
King Avenue over in kind of in the Grandview.
At North Shore.
And that store has been there forever. It really hasn't changed that much. The contents may have changed over the years, but it's kind of like one of those little drive-up places that you stop on your way home.
Yeah, and Gentiles has been very supportive of Ohio wines. Roger is anything but a wine snob. And so if he likes something, he doesn't care what the label says and others to bastardize something that H.L. Mencken once said. He said, he doesn't drink labels. He drinks what's inside the bottle.
Why is it that people who like wine are considered wine snobs?
Well, because I think a lot of them play to the audience of the rest of us who are not into wines and are faced with the maybe 10,000 choices just in one state like Ohio, and wonder what to drink. And if we're lucky, we find a wine we like, and then we're afraid to go beyond that because we may have had some bad experiences, and we have all this press that's giving 100-point ratings on a 100-point scale to people who will then ignore a 92 rating in favor of a 93 from the same winery. The glamour and hoopla about wine is just out of control, and it's, I think, discouraged a lot of people from drinking wines, and it's also made a lot of people think that the price of wine reflects the quality. It doesn't. It has absolutely nothing to do with it. It's supply and demand, just like any commodity.
That's what Lehrer's article was about. It said that some of the wines that were 5% of the price of some of the French wines scored equally well in terms of people's preferences for them. And he also raised questions about how objective the numerical standard was, if you could really take sensory characteristics and turn them into something numerical. And honestly, if you could take anything that was sensory and turn it into something numerical, I bet you and I would both be on board because it would make our jobs much easier. I mean, we could be objective every place we went. We could have our little point scale, but I think our senses are necessarily subjective. And so that...
Yeah, because it's an aesthetic.
Yeah.
You're trying to put aesthetics into a 100-point scale. Yet you wouldn't dream of buying a piece of art based on a 100-point scale. You wouldn't choose your silverware pattern based on some expert's rating.
Yeah. Mona Lisa, 75.3.
Yes.
Yeah.
Would you choose the color you're going to paint your walls based on somebody's rating of that particular tint? It's ridiculous. You, the best rater is you, and the best test is you with the wine in the glass in front of you, not what somebody says in a handbook.
But
or,
as
or
you
even
point out,
a vintage chart.
Even if you find something you like and it may not be expensive, go ahead and enjoy it, but
explore,
be willing
yes.
to
explore things that are like it.
And of course, what you're eating makes a difference in how the wine tastes.
Sure, and you'll find over time the combinations that you like, which are much more important than the recommended combinations from any expert.
What's your favorite combination? You knew that was coming.
See, there is no such thing.
Oh. There what's your 100 level?
So it doesn't have to be wine and cheese.
Let me give you two expert recommendations as what to have with Roquefort cheese. And I mean real Roquefort, which is a very, as we know, is a very strong cheese. One expert recommendation is to have a red wine from the Rhone region, you know, a southern French red wine, a strong one. And it almost doesn't matter what it is. It should be just a dry table wine of exceptional strength and finish. The other recommendation is to have a Sauternes or a Barsac, a very sweet white wine from Bordeaux. So choose, pick and choose. Tell
so
me
you're going to have two very different
experiences. Well, tell me that, convince me that they're both wrong or one's right or one's I think they're right according to individual taste.
Or your mood.
But you're going, your mood in the daytime, the weather, what you've had previously, what was in the rest of the meal, these things are all very subjective, and the only person with the right answer is you.
Now, when people ask me what my favorites are, I usually say, well, at this particular moment in time, I like this, but ask me in an hour and see if that's still my answer. It
yes.
probably won't be. I mean, you know.
Well, that's why the subject fascinates us, because there is no set answer. If there were set answers, we'd all do the same thing. We'd all be trying to buy the same wines, buy the same food, and go to the same restaurants. But thank God we don't.
292-8513, or you can email us here at allsides@wosu.org. And Lisa is joining us. Good morning, Lisa.
Yeah, the best part I like about John's comments sometimes are when he tells us who's got the cleanest kitchens.
And we were talking about that before off the air. I would like a collection of those somewhere, like if you put them all in mini paragraphs.
I think
sorry,
that's what Lisa's
interrupt.
Looking for, too. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly.
Well, the cleanest kitchens traditionally, and I say this because of some time I spent working at the State Health Department and talking to the people in the sanitation division, which oversee restaurant inspections throughout the state. The sad answer to your question is that the cleanest kitchens are those run by chain operations, because they are rigorously
and punctilious. They have more assets to protect, right?
Yes.
If you sue them, you can go all of McDonald's.
They have better training. They have they can afford to have staffs who go around to the restaurants anonymously and make surprise inspections. So the chain restaurants are the safest from the strict sense. If you're looking at individually owned restaurants, I'm afraid the only way you can really figure that one out is to go in the kitchen yourself, which is something I don't do during reviews because I'm trying to keep as low a profile as possible.
But there are different ratings from the health department, are there not, so that the
green.
Health department sticker on the door
like
should
green.
Give you some indication.
That's the right green.
Right, but you know, an operation can go from green to whatever the
yellow.
Failing.
I think right. I think
well,
it's like a stoplight,
a,
isn't it?
Is
yellow
a,
is iffy, and red is forget
yes,
it.
Yes, I think it's red. Red is basically closed.
Yeah.
In overnight, what I don't like in that I'm seeing outside the kitchens and on the serving floors is servers who are continually putting their hands to their face, including their mouths and their noses, and then carrying on. And then others who are careless about how they pick up patrons, how they bus tables. I think having servers bus tables is a bad idea because when they're in a rush, they pick up glasses and mugs by the rims. And
they're trying to minimize their trips to the kitchen,
and
they're
I guarantee they don't go sanitize their hands after that, and they could be bringing your entree on the very next trip. So there's a lot of reinforcement and training that has to be done by the individual operator. It's an unforgiving business, running a restaurant, and sanitation is one of the biggest crosses I think a restaurant owner and manager has to bear, because there's so much turnover in restaurants here with the serving staff that you're always training. And you can't assume that people have been properly trained at home when they were growing up as to what proper sanitation is. So we can use our eyes when we're in a restaurant, and if we see a lot of lax habits, I think it's time to leave.
Well, as restaurant reviewers, do you ever say anything to anybody if you see something that's really egregious?
Well, again, that goes with the profile we're trying to keep.
Yeah, I've never thought a relationship would turn out well in a restaurant if I corrected somebody. So I'm as likable as I can be, and then I don't mind
doing that when I'm in a restaurant on my own dime, just eating for myself, not for a review.
But it goes in the review.
Yes.
Because it seems to me that another time that you were here, you're very much of the mind that reviews are for consumers. Not for restaurants.
That's correct. And I don't think any of the other reviewers would quarrel with that.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I'm interested. You said you would correct someone. Have you? And if you don't mind. And what would you say? Like, don't pick up my glass by the rim. I can't imagine you saying that. I mean,
No, I just ask people to wash their hands and put on gloves if that's what it takes.
This is, as you say, a very, very tough...
But again, that's when I'm there on my
I know. Own. I'm just trying to imagine this.
But it is a very tough restaurant. If you have some of these small, independently owned places where the owner is in charge not only of the kitchen and hiring and the building itself, but in buying food and training, and typically the first round of training goes toward the menu.
Yes.
This is what you're selling.
Yeah. I have found that the best run... restaurants from a sanitation standpoint, and we're talking about locally owned ones, are those that are owned and run by veterans, people who are not new to the business, because they've seen it all and they have realized from bitter experience that nothing succeeds like having a clean kitchen and a clean serving area and clean habits with the servers.
And, of course, it goes beyond just surfaces. You've got to have hood ranges cleaned periodically, all sorts of commercially cleaned equipment, that kind of thing. It's not just wiping down countertops and whatnot.
That's correct. And they should, if they have a pocket thermometer in their shirt pocket, then so much the better. It shows that they're going around and checking the temperature.
And rinsing after they check the temperature.
Either cold or hot enough.
292-8513, that's the number to call if you have questions about restaurants or food in the Columbus area. And, of course, this week that has been a real issue in restaurants, keeping food at a certain
safe
temperature.
Yeah.
And it's got to be safe. You know, you can't be selling food that is going to make somebody sick.
No, we were talking about that, too, that John had been at a restaurant and had a good experience, and it had been the same one that I had not had such a good experience. And we were trying to figure out whether or not it was a hygiene issue, or if it may also have been, and we didn't get this far in the conversation, it may have been a combination of a lot of fat and a lot of heat. And sometimes if the fat is rancid, and which can happen, and the heat, like the spicy, that combo is really hard on me. I can't imagine that anybody would be good with rancid fat and heat. I mean,
if it's regular food poisoning, it's basically a 3-day cycle. You eat it on day one. On day two, you're so sick, you're afraid you're going to die.
Yes,
and then on day three, you're still so sick that now you're afraid you're not going to die because you want to die. And that's the traditional cycle of classic food poisoning.
Yeah, I think salmonella, right?
Yes.
I had that from chicken before. I mean, I had exactly that experience.
We've even had the situation here at work where people have been out in the sun and not drinking enough fluids and actually having to go to the hospital because of heat-related illnesses. And you don't know how much you're bringing to the equation,
That is also true. And it makes it hard, you know, when you're trying to figure out, well, is the source of this something in my lifestyle, or is the source of my sickness something that the community should be warned about?
Well, what do you do when you've gone to a restaurant and had a bad experience like that?
You know, I talk to my editor candidly. So I think that's because they understand the laws and what my responsibilities are. They have a better understanding of that than I do, because I think about food and how consumers feel. That's my responsibility, to know a lot about food. And then we work together to find language that will hopefully communicate that this may not be a positive experience for many palates. I don't think I've ever felt like something was such a public health risk. I've never felt that something was like that people should be warned, because I think if that was the case, I would call the cops or the health department. I don't think I'd put it in ink. I'd do something
more
aggressive.
Call 911.
Yes.
What about your responsibility as a reviewer to perhaps go back? Do you need to give it a second chance?
I absolutely think so.
Or sure one bad agree. Experience, yeah. Is that pretty much end it?
No, I think the tradition with publishers is that they want you to go back. In most cases, I would be going back a third time.
So you give it two shots to begin with.
And then
yes.
You say something like uneven service, you know, or there might be a glitch in this. Because it doesn't mean that the bad experience didn't happen, but it means that it's possible to have a good experience.
And how about you, Miriam? You feel that your responsibility is to consumers, to diners?
Absolutely, yeah. But any place merits more than one visit. Like if it's fantastic, it still merits more than one visit, because you can't send them off to spend all their money and then find out that it's not a guaranteed home run.
Of course, it's a kind of a weighty issue, because you've got somebody's livelihood resting in the balance. Not that a bad review is necessarily going to doom a restaurant, but it can hurt it. And you don't want to take down a local business.
Yeah, and you know, as online reviews have gained more weight and prominence, I often wonder about that, because you know, I think disgruntled employees probably are 10% of the online reviewers.
At least. Then there's competitors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the climate is evolving in an interesting fashion, and I think that makes our jobs evolve a little bit too. I don't know how, but I will know in retrospect.
Well, we hear it all the time in the newsroom, people who fashion themselves as civilian journalists.
Vigilantes?
Well, citizen journalists.
Yes.
And
that's
we
good.
Certainly have
that's good. Yeah.
All sorts of websites now where you can review a place. And what can an owner do? I mean, if they get slammed by somebody, there's not much they can do about it, unfairly.
Yeah, there's not much they can do that's practical, because if they want to mount a full-scale operation to retrieve whatever part of their reputation they think they've lost from a particular website or more typically a blog, they're going to have to spend some money. And is it worth it? And how do they know that every one of their customers is reading the same blog that stabbed them in the heart? People take it very personally when they see something like that, and the owners, I think, take it out of context. They attribute too much importance to a blog.
I think when we get slammed, we all get. I mean, it hurts to be slammed generally.
I think some of them would rather have their children criticized.
Thank you both very much, John Christensen of the Columbus Dispatch, Miriam Bowers Abbott of The Other Paper. I'm Marilyn Smith. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. It's 12 o'clock. News from NPR is next.